Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. For the next 4 weeks, we'll be offering you the best of Talking History, or at least the most popular programs of the past year, based on listener response and visits to our website archive of shows at oah.org. This week, we present our program from the week of October 6, 2002. It includes an interview with Charles Sable of the Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design on the history of woman and sex in advertising, as well as a commentary by Dr. America on the Mall of America's 10th anniversary. We take up the program with Joey Skidmore's This Week in History.
This week in history, on October 12, 1492, Christopher Columbus reached the shores of what he proclaimed to be the New World, which was news to the continent's inhabitants. Columbus actually thought he had landed in Asia. He was born in Genoa, Italy in 1451. Little is known of his early life, but he worked as a seaman and then a maritime entrepreneur. He became obsessed with the possibility of pioneering a western sea route to Cathay, or China, India, and the gold and spice islands of Asia. At the time, Europeans knew no direct sea route to southern Asia, and the route via Egypt and the Red Sea was closed to Europeans by the Ottoman Empire, as were many land routes. Contrary to popular legend, educated Europeans of Columbus's day did not believe that the world was flat. However, Columbus and most others underestimated the world's size, calculating that East Asia must lie approximately where North America sits on the globe. They had yet to discover the Pacific Ocean. On August 3, 1492, Columbus set sail from Palos, Spain, with three small ships, the Santa Maria, the Pinta, and the Niña. And on October 12th, the expedition reached land, probably Watling Island in the Bahamas. Columbus would return to the Americas, named after one of his competitors, three more times, discovering, or perhaps more accurately invading, depending upon your perspective, various Caribbean islands, the Gulf of Mexico, and the South and Central American mainlands. He never did accomplish his original goal, finding a western ocean route to the great cities of Asia, and died in Spain in 1506.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, Michael Egan, an English professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, believes he has proof that an Elizabethan play found several years ago but never identified as to its source was written by William Shakespeare. "I discovered the text about a year ago," Egan said in announcing his discovery, "and as soon as I read it, I recognized Shakespeare's hand. His fingerprints are all over it. The document survives only as an illegible manuscript, written mainly with a quill pen and lacking a title page and an ending. But Egan insists that it is the prequel to the Bard's Richard II. The manuscript found its way into the British Museum and eventually into the hands of five successive scholars who published their own editions. Each struggled to make sense of the anonymous Elizabethan copyist's atrocious penmanship and lack of punctuation and came up with significantly different readings. None of them regarded it as Shakespeare's work. And in another literary discovery, of sorts, the image of Janis Joplin, dead for 30 years now and long fixed as a blues-belting, bourbon-drinking rock icon who lived fast and died young, may be changed as a result of the discovery of a series of her letters dating to 1965. They were written 2 years before her breakthrough at the Monterey Pop Festival, and they reveal a studious homebody, singing alone in her room, but battling the demons that eventually claimed her life. "I've just been attempting to look at my life objectively from my new happy vantage point," she wrote in one typically reflective letter to her then-boyfriend, Peter DeBlanc. The letters were written from her hometown in Port Arthur, Texas. Joplin was enrolled in a local college, Lamar Tech, and one of her drawings in the collection shows Joplin in what she described as her nice green Christmas dress, groovy old sandals, and new thin gold hoop earrings. Joplin wrote of her efforts to keep her musical ambitions alive, practicing in her room as her father listened to Bach downstairs. But in her last letter, dated November 11, 1965, she said that she was taking Librium and seeing a counselor in an effort to cling to her sobriety. 15 years later, at the height of her career, Janis Joplin died of an accidental overdose of heroin in a Hollywood hotel. This is Talking History.
Come on, come on, come on, sitting on the
When did women first appear in advertising? What products did they advertise? When did advertisers discover that sex sells? And how have images of women in advertising changed over the years? Talking History's Eileen Dugan, professor of history at Creighton University, explores these and other related questions with her guest, Charles Sable.
A recent advertising campaign asks the age-old question, what are little girls made of? We all know the answer, sugar and spice and everything nice. But instead of cute kids in frilly dresses, we see female athletes mountain biking, snowboarding, and barreling through the desert in an SUV. Executives at this automaker explain that this commercial is aimed at active lifestyle women. My, but how the perception of women has changed in American advertising. Or has it? Well, joining us today to discuss images of women in advertising is Mr. Charles Sable of the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mr. Sable is curator of a fascinating exhibit at the Museum on Advertising's Changing Images of Women in Postwar America. Hello, Mr. Sable. For what types of products did women first begin appearing in advertising?
Well, women appear in ads as far back as the 1880s and 1890s. And the first type of ads that women appear in were for things like what we would call today domestic products, household cleaners and things like that. And the ads depicted relieving women of women's work, meaning household chores, and making their lives a little bit easier. That's the kind of thing we see for things like laundry products, things like disinfectants, like, should I name a product? Things like Lysol and products like that. You find women appearing in ads. But they also appear in ads for things like early beauty products, like you have, or cleaning products, or sanitary products, I should say. As early as the 1880s and 1890s, you find Ivory soap using women, for example, which goes way back to the 1860s, actually. Or for things like women's, or products aimed at women specifically. There are some great ads that I was just recently looking at for women's hosiery for the 19-teens and 20s. And that continues up until the 40s and 50s. But you also have, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, ads that talk about women's roles in society, like the woman who was left behind, the spinster, you don't want to be like this woman. And that leads into where we go into the 50s, where why can't this woman get a man? Why can't this woman find a husband? What's wrong with her? And it leads into what I call the traditional role for the exhibit, the traditional female role, either the woman who needs to get a man, find a man, and once she has a man, then become the ideal wife and mother.
So how is a woman supposed to get a man, according to advertisers?
Through sex, through appeal, through, in the traditional female role as I define it in the show, a woman is supposed to get a man by becoming the virtuous young lady who is sexy, but not too sexy, not a tramp, but find that man, make him want her, basically, and then, of course, marry her. So she becomes then the bride and then, of course, the virtuous domestic, what shall I say, goddess, who maintains her family life to a T and is happy all the time.
When did advertisers begin using the idea of the sexual woman in terms of advertising geared towards men?
I think that really comes up. That's a tough question. But in my digging around and looking and perusal of ads, it goes back as early as the 19-teens and 20s, but certainly by the 30s and 40s you find it. Somewhere in that time, undoubtedly post-World War I. You may have one or two pre-World War I ads, but certainly in the 1920s and 30s is what you really find the sexual sort of innuendos starting. And certainly in the 40s and 50s you have it.
Well, can you give us an example of that?
Yeah. A good ad is the Coca-Cola ad, which has a woman lying in a sort of skimpy two-piece bathing suit. It dates from the World War II period. And it's the big Coca-Cola logo, and there's a hand, presumably a male hand, offering a Coke. And the only, was a billboard and a print ad. And she says, yes.
Now, that's
a great example.
It is.
But it's considered a classic of Coca-Cola advertising.
But they weren't so subtle afterwards, were they?
They weren't so subtle afterwards?
No.
Coca-Cola, you're saying. No, Coca-Cola got more demure after that. But there's always an undertone in a lot of Coca-Cola ads and also soft drink ads. Pepsi, did the same thing in the 50s, the Think Young. In fact, there's been a recent revival of it, sort of a almost a caricature of it with Britney Spears recently. She's done a whole series of ads, retro ads, looking back at Pepsi-Cola advertising, where she actually does the original, these are TV commercials, obviously, where she does the vintage ad campaign. And it was, the one in the 50s was Think Young. And she's surrounded by fresh-faced young men in a diner, and she sings this little ditty and dances around with them. But it's very sexual, as Britney Spears is today. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, yes. When did, along with the idea of the domestic woman and the sexual woman, when did we begin to see images of stronger and more independent career women?
That comes much later than what, than the period, time period I'm talking about. That only emerges in the, well, in the mid to late 1960s. It's part of the pop culture revolution, or the new woman is how I defined it in the exhibit, where you find strong, independent women. And we refer to it in the exhibit as really the second wave of feminism, the first wave becoming the late 50s and early 60s, when you find the stronger, more independent career woman. And we had a lot of print ads in the show talking about, from the 60s and 70s, I should say, talking about a woman in a new career role. And that has to do with the changes in society, as I've mentioned, in the 60s, the feminist movements, but also changes in American culture as well on a more generic level. More women in the workplace, more career women, as women economically in families needed to work, especially in the 70s, you find ad aimed at the career woman.
And was there a message in these ads that even though the woman worked, she still had to do her work at home?
Sure. Oh, yeah. The ads were, I can think of one that we had in the show for an aspirin product, where isn't your life tough enough? You've got work and family, yet you can't handle it all, so how about some aspirin, is basically what it said. Or the famous television commercial where the woman sings a ditty, I can bring home the bacon and fry it up in a pan. And I think it was for a cologne, actually, a women's or perfume. And never let you forget you're a man. That was the actual slogan that they used in the television commercial. This is about late 1970s.
Oh, I remember that one.
Mm-hmm.
How do the current lean cuisine commercials seem to overturn all of this old domestic ideal?
Well, that's a very good question, because the lean cuisine ads go into the sort of woman as what I called in the show just one of the boys, because they are so career-oriented that these are presumably, in the commercial you're referring to, there are a group of women standing in an elevator and talking about what they had for dinner last night. And one said, I had a crock of cheese bread, and I had an apple and a leftover piece of pizza. And, of course, the third woman said, I had the most delicious chicken fettuccine and herb-roasted potatoes and blah, 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 blah. And all the others are looking at her like, how? Why? How did you have the time to make all this stuff? And, of course, we know it was lean cuisine. And so they're talking about women as total career women, not women who have to do double duty, but women now who are, as I said, just one of the boys.
When did women start becoming more sexually aggressive in ads? I mean, I think of the flirtatious Charlie girl, or
mm-hmm.
the women who were drooling over a hunky construction worker in the
yes.
Diet Coke ad. When did they start that?
You see that happening. Well, you see sexuality in ads, as I mentioned earlier on. In the 60s, you start to see a little bit of that, but in sort of a Madonna, caricature Madonna-type fashion. But you really start to see that in the 70s. With, as you mentioned, the Charlie girl. It was one of the first of them. My favorite is the great L'Oreal ad that starred Meredith Baxter Burney, is in 1973, where the woman talks about, because I'm worth it and because I'm a strong, independent woman, she is overtly sexual in that ad. Meredith Baxter Burney is. And those continued with Heather Locklear in the 80s into the 90s as well, where they're using their sexuality but also talking about themselves as a strong woman. And it's what I'm basically trying to say is it's part and parcel of this stronger, independent woman now who can be sexual for her own, in her own right, as opposed to in the previous traditional role trying to capture a man through sexuality.
How prominent have women been actually in the development of advertising campaigns?
There have been some major female copywriters in advertising campaigns. The most important of these was a woman named Shirley Polycoff, who created the infamous Does She or Doesn't She campaign for Clairol hair coloring. she basically reversed female roles in that campaign. That was, we're talking roughly 1958 to about 1965 or so. Your public should remember, may remember those campaigns, was, does this woman color hair? Is it acceptable to color her hair? And the answer, of course, is yes, because does she or doesn't she? Only her hairdresser knows for sure as the campaign went on. Shirley Polakoff was an important figure because she changed traditional female roles in the use of hair coloring. She understood what made women tick. She herself was a successful career woman who had a family. Probably the other great female copywriter that I think of who's still working today is a woman named Ilan Specht. And Ilan Specht created the, as I mentioned, the famous campaign for L'Oreal. Because I'm Worth It, in 1973, in frustration with male advertising executives who wouldn't take her seriously. And she said, Because I'm Worth It was written out of frustration, as she told me when I interviewed her for the show. And there have been many others since then. But those are the two pathfinders in the 60s and the 70s in the field. And there, as I said, there are lots of women copywriters today whose trails were blazed by these two strong, independent women.
How have women athletes been portrayed in advertising?
Well, traditionally, women athletes were portrayed as Billie Jean King, I'm thinking of, or even earlier in advertising, were portrayed as themselves within the traditional roles of their time periods. Today, of course, as you mentioned earlier, they are portrayed as independent figures, very much not as strong as male athletes, perhaps. I think we're still in that transition period, but I think that's on the horizon.
And, for example,
Martina Navratilova, I can't pronounce her name.
Navratilova.
Thank you. For the Subaru, I think that's the all-wheel drive car, all-wheel drive sport car. I think she's presented as herself, and, of course, her sexual orientation is hinted at in that ad. Well, we're just girls, as she says. What will we know? And, of course, she's a strong, independent person. That's a real breakthrough ad. About 1999-2000, that ad aired.
Mm-hmm. And yet we still have Anna Kournikova, who is the babe.
Right. The babe. Well, that's another aspect that I talk about in the show, is mixed messages. Today, and I think for the last roughly 10 years or so, since the early 90s, we've had throwbacks to older representations of women, but these new strong types as well. And then another type that I haven't referred to yet, what I refer to in the show is the superwoman, the woman who can do anything. As one of the ads in the show talks about, the bendable, stretchable, unique, modern woman, like, as I said, who can do anything she sets her mind to. As I said, the superwoman, the supermom. So that's yet another thread within this mixed message thing. So some of these traditional roles that I've talked about continue. Many of them continue. In fact, we had some what I would call negative ads for a liquor company, which were overtly sexual, blatantly sexual, in sort of a 50s or early 60s sort of mode in the show. Now, were they caricatures? Were they or retros? We don't know, but they're out there.
When we think also of women in advertising, we have to think of lingerie advertising. How has that evolved over the years?
Very, very interestingly, when you look at lingerie ads early on, they were always very demure. I'm talking about teens, 20s, 30s. Some hosiery ads that I mentioned to you earlier were very, very simple and very arty. What's happened is they've become maybe not so overtly sexual as the Coca-Cola ad that I mentioned to you a little while ago, but they're certainly out there. I'm talking about things like Victoria's Secret ads today, which can be quite beautiful, but can also be very lacy and frilly as well in their sort of approach. So, yes, there's a lot of sexuality, implied sexuality in there, but there might not be as overt as some ads that are out there today. And there's a consciousness of not being too strenuous in those ads. I'm being generic in my sort of approach here.
We only have a moment remaining, but just one wrap-up question. How much has the image of women changed in advertising, or how much has it stayed the same?
I think that's a question that I grappled with in the show. I think there have been strong changes, especially in the last, since the 70s, with the new approach as the strong, independent woman. As society has changed, advertising, I would argue, has reflected some of the changes we've seen in society. But there are always these vestiges. Advertising is not monolithic. It changes with the society and reflects the changes in society. But we also have what I would perhaps call retardataire ads, being, that's my own personal biases here coming through. backward-looking ads, ads that reflect the past, and ads, some ads that consciously reflect the past, as I mentioned, the Britney Spears TV ads, that, which look at nostalgia as well. I don't know where advertising or representations of women in advertising are going in the future. I think the change in society will represent those changes as well, or will be presented in advertising. But certainly it's changed dramatically, especially in the last 15, 20 years.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Sable.
My pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
Okay. We have been talking with Mr. Charles Sable of the William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Welcome back. For our site of the week, Talking History's Joey Skidmore thought it appropriate to tell you a little about the museum at which Eileen Dugan's guest, Charles Sable, works.
The William F. Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design is part of the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. Its curators, including Charles Sable, subscribe to Marshall McLuhan's words that historians and archaeologists will one day discover that the ads of our time are the richest and most faithful reflections that any society ever made of its entire range of activities. And they've dedicated themselves to studying how our massive exposure to advertising affects our perceptions of the world, ourselves, and others. Current exhibits at the Eisner include Profiles and Big League Pitching. Profiles addresses the question, how advertisers know who we are and what we buy. It explains the psychological and demographic profile used in marketing and advertising. Big League Pitching looks at the marketing of Major League Baseball in a variety of media outlets, ranging from the nation's smaller cities and towns to the larger markets of cities like New York or Los Angeles. Big League Pitching closes on November 3rd. Profiles runs through the end of the year at the Eisner Museum of Advertising and Design in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Minnesota's Mall of America celebrates its 10th anniversary this year, and Dr. America was present for the festivities. Many of the speakers at the official ceremonies reviewed the mall's history, but few of them put the Mega Mall in historical perspective. This week, in the magnificent but wholly imaginary American Studies Museum, Dr. America probes the mall's aesthetic precedents.
In terms of size, Minnesota's Mall of America is the largest in the United States. Its floor space is about the same as Chicago's Sears Tower. The mall is capacious enough to hold 258 Statues of Liberty, or 67 Washington Monuments. Its 7-acre amusement park is entirely inside the mall, as are 38,000 live plants. And it receives over 40 million visitors a year. The Mall of America is basically a retail planet, like Jupiter, with gravity so powerful that it just pulls people into its orbit. A few years ago, Dr. America attended an academic conference on the Mall of America. One speaker noted, in a standard trope of giganticism, that the Mall of America attracts more visitors every year than all of the U.S. national parks and monuments combined. Later in the program, a speaker from France expressed some confusion. "I thought the Mall of America was a national monument," he said, with dry French irony. In this regard, the Mall of America is the epitome of what Dr. America calls the commercial sublime. In the 19th century, the sublime referred to landscapes so awesome that they made people feel small in the cosmos. Niagara Falls and the Rocky Mountains were standard subjects of this artistic sublime. These popular paintings led to what Dr. America calls the National Park Sublime, the creation of nature preserves designed to preserve our sense of humility in the world. We see remnants of this tradition in the contemporary SUV Sublime, which honors the glorious landscapes of the natural sublime even while foregrounding a second and now more popular sublime. As the Industrial Revolution progressed, this second sublime, a technological sublime, arose to celebrate the achievements of an urban industrial world. It referred to inventions so awesome that they made people feel large in the cosmos. The railroad sublime, for example, celebrated the power and productivity of its steam engines of progress. The skyscraper sublime celebrated the dominance of the city, the power of the business corporation, and the genius of the building engineer. Skyscrapers like the Empire State Building and the World Trade Center were monuments to American capitalism and technological prowess. In retailing, the first instances of the commercial sublime were the huge department stores that spread out next to the soaring skyscrapers downtown. Occupying an entire city block, these emporiums of trade celebrated what historian William Leach calls the land of desire, the consumer culture in which desire flows like the torrent of Niagara Falls. Shopping centers moved this Malthusian multiplication of desires to the suburbs, where it has eventuated in gargantuan projects like the Mall of America. And the result is sublime. When we enter the mall, we feel simultaneously large and small, able to experience hubris and humility at the same time. The mountains of merchandise offer so many possibilities that we could, it seems, shop until we drop. From the American Studies Museum, this is Dr. America, outlining the traditions of American culture and wondering if and when the awesome becomes simply awful.
You've been listening to Dr. America, also known as James Farrell, Professor of History and American Studies at St. Olaf College. Farrell's commentary comes to us courtesy of Minnesota Public Radio Station WCAL in Minneapolis. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau. Well, down on me.